This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. The historic town of Windsor, situated along the Kashai River, is a warm and welcoming community that promotes ecotourism and kayak and paddling opportunities. The town of 3,200 people is also home to one of the country's few municipal zoos, with buffalo, llamas, ostriches, emus, and peacocks. Windsor is a charming place to live or visit, but it's also had its struggles. Last week, the Kashai River spilled its banks and floodwaters inundated downtown and areas of Bertie County. As much as 10 feet of standing water was reported in some buildings. A state of emergency was issued by Governor Pat McCrory last Thursday as emergency crews and swift water rescue teams from across the state pulled 138 people from homes and buildings at the height of flooding. The flooding has subsided now, and a damage assessment team from Raleigh was called in to survey some of the hardest hit areas on Monday. Bertie County Manager Scott Sauer says they're estimating $1.43 million in damages.
In the single family category, we've got 57 homes that were impacted, one destroyed, 32 sustaining major damage, and 24 sustaining minor damage.
44 local businesses were damaged by flooding, and 12 mobile homes were a complete loss. This is an all-too-familiar situation for Bertie County. In 1999, Hurricane Floyd devastated downtown Windsor. It happened again in 2010 after several days of heavy rain.
Bertie County is ranked as the number one most economically distressed county in the state. So to be at that position on a good day and then experience the third 500-year flood in 17 years is just devastating for our community.
This week, residents and businesses began the long process of recovery, tearing out ruined belongings and rebuilding their lives. On Tuesday, I visited Windsor to witness the damage firsthand. Along King Street, still blocked by police, piles of waterlogged furniture, rolled up carpet, shelves, disintegrated cardboard boxes, soaked appliances, and heaps of trash bags lined both sides of the streets. The sights, sounds, and the very distinct musty smell that accompanies flood cleanup is exactly how I remember it when I was in this spot 6 years ago reporting on flood damage. However, this time, the streets are mostly empty. Folks have already salvaged what they can and thrown away what can't be saved. Cleanup and restoration companies are power washing mud and debris from inside downtown businesses, and large fans stand in the doorways to circulate air and prevent mold from growing.
People have really hit the ground running. I mean, nobody's hesitating to get busy, to get things cleaned out, drying out buildings, and trying to get things back to normal as quickly as possible.
Over on East Granville Street, only about 200 yards from the Kashai River, I ran into restoration specialist with the State Historic Preservation Office, Reed Thomas. He's part of a statewide cultural resources emergency support team deployed to Windsor to save antique farming implements and tools in the Craftsman and Farmers Museum. Outreach coordinator with the Department of Natural and Cultural Resources, Adrian Burney, points to a pencil line inside the doorframe of the museum's office.
We had some people from emergency management in here yesterday. Making notes, so that's little notation for their high water mark, HWM. So I think that's about 4 feet.
And the governor stopped by here the day before to survey the damage and meet the team. Their restoration efforts continue today as volunteers bring old leather saddles, tools, and other farming implements one by one outside to dry in the sun. And then they rub them with isopropyl alcohol, which Bernie explains is a safe way to preserve artifacts and deter mold growth.
Some of the tags washed off in the flood, identification tags, so we're re-tagging them with Tyvek, which is a lot more water-resistant and pest-resistant material than paper that had been before. We have a lot of fans going inside the building to keep the air circulating to help prevent those additional spores from settling and new spores from germinating.
The Crest team was able to clean and restore all of the items that were submerged, and fortunately, no major artifacts were destroyed by floodwaters. But not everyone in Bertie County was so lucky.
We had about 2 to 2.5 feet of water inside the house, and we just lost everything.
Windsor resident Lawrence Williams lives only a couple hundred feet from the Kashai River.
I just don't know where we can go from there. Just believing, asking God, you know, just go from there. That's all I can say.
Williams is among dozens of people seeking financial assistance at a mobile disaster recovery center parked at the Bertie County Social Services building. The expandable 18-wheeler provided by State Emergency Management offers workspace and communications capabilities. It officially opened Tuesday, but Senior Disaster Manager for American Red Cross in Eastern North Carolina, David Garrison, says they helped about 30 residents who showed up early on Monday.
We can do the emergency assistance, which is they would get a debit card with money loaded on it, and it depends on how many people's in the home and that information.
The parking lot is busy. People have been coming and going all morning. It's about 11 o'clock, and Garrison says they've had 30 families register today. In addition to emergency assistance through Red Cross, residents who experience flood damage can speak with voluntary organizations about help with cleanup and salvaging personal belongings. Disaster Response Superintendent Cliff Harville is with the North Carolina Conference of the United Methodist Church. He says they're mobilizing 8 to 10 volunteers to assist with recovery.
And then also we go into tear out after they understand what resources they have to rebuild. We go ahead and get it torn out so that it can be drying out and getting ready to so that a family can make a decision of what their next step is.
At this point, Harville says they're trying to determine how many people need help, and then they can begin recovery efforts. But the cleanup can't come fast enough for Michelle Fluker.
Ain't no rebuilding, restoring for me. We broke, homeless, penniless. I can't even go back to work right now because I don't know where I'm going to lay my head or what I'm going to do with these kids. Somebody need to help us.
Fluker is staying at a nearby hotel with her 8 children since the home she rents near the Kashai River is flooded. At the highest point, she says there was 4 feet of standing water inside.
You know, a snake swim around my bedroom as we speak, brand new mattress, and they swimming all across my bed, all on the floor. 50-inch color TV in there, I'm scared to go get. A snapping turtle is walking through my living room. I wouldn't even let it out the house.
Emotions are running high. There's a sense of hopelessness that permeates conversations with flood victims waiting to get into the recovery center. Some express anger, others hold back tears. Most of the people I speak with, some who declined to be interviewed because they were too upset, said they feel like they weren't getting help.
Staying in this one room down here at the Windsor Inn, I got one more morning, which is tomorrow, before I'm out. They gave me $500 and sent me on my way and told me good luck to you. This ain't right.
Many of the people seeking help at the Disaster Assistance Center want to get back on their feet as quickly as possible. But Disaster Response Superintendent Harville says recovery takes weeks, months, and even years.
So we have to determine who we can help. We have to determine how we can help them. And then we've got to figure out what's going to be the best way to pull a plan together to be able to help the folks. So we can't promise anything. You know, when they're coming in, we tell them what we do if you qualify. So when they leave here, they don't know whether they qualify or not, because they're still in the process, so to speak, for us to determine whether or not we can help them.
Harville asks residents to be patient, and if they qualify for assistance, he promises that in return,
we're going to do the best we can to bring their home up to a point to where they can move on with their life, and it'll be a good quality of life, safe, sanitary, and secure place to live, and they'll be able to put the storm behind them.
Windsor resident Lenora Sessoms is hopeful that she'll get a phone call soon that volunteers will help her salvage belongings.
Everything I own is underwater. So now I got all these years, 50 years of, well, it's just material things, but I have pictures and stuff that can't be replaced. But it's gonna be okay.
Through the sadness and loss of property, Sessoms is able to keep a positive outlook by bringing humor into a bleak situation.
I mean, I've shed a few tears. Don't think I called my pastor. They say I'm very comical. I said, Reverend Moore, I said, I didn't even get my good wig. My good wig floating in the water. He said, Miss Lenore, he said, you're my favorite. I'm sorry, sometimes you got to laugh to keep from crying. I said, I didn't even get my good hair. But it's okay. I'm good.
It's only been a week since floodwaters receded. Most of the folks I spoke with told me that this was their first time experiencing flooding in their home and the devastating loss it causes. Disaster Response Superintendent Harville says the hardest part moving forward is that residents have to let go of the past and adjust to a new normal.
And hopefully that new normal will be at a place where they can move beyond this flood. They can put it behind them. Until they can get that debris out of their yard, until they can get their home cleaned out and rebuilt, this flood is going to stay with them.
That's why disaster response crews are on the ground, assisting homeowners in Bertie County with cleanup. The State Emergency Management Mobile Disaster Center remains at the Social Services Building in Windsor, and so far, the Red Cross has provided assistance to 60 families with 17 cases waiting for approval. It's estimated that 40 to 50 residents will need home repair and rebuilding assistance.
We count our blessings that no one was killed. Injuries were very, very minor. Just simply asking that folks keep us in their thoughts and prayers.
While federal disaster assistance remains unlikely, Bertie County Manager Scott Sauer says they should know by next week if state funding is available to help flood victims. I'm Jared Brumbaugh. The East Carolina University School of Economics is hosting its annual Lunchtime Business Symposium on the State of the Economy, Monday, October 3rd, at the Greenville Hilton. The symposium focuses on broader economic issues and how they're relevant to local businesses and individuals in eastern North Carolina. Chris Thomas this week spoke to one of its founders, Dr. Randall Parker, a macroeconomist at the university, who says the symposium is an example of how a university should serve its community.
I think the purpose of a university is to educate the children of the good tax-paying citizens of this state, to make them functioning members of our society and of our republic, number one, but also to conduct research and to have findings of new knowledge and to understand what we know about economics or biology or physics or medicine, and then disseminate that information to the tax-paying public, who, after all, are the people paying our salaries, to try to inform them as best we can about what the scholars know about the state of knowledge for relevant topics in the public interest, more especially the economics of elections, which we have coming up right now.
How did the symposium get started, and when did it get started?
Back in 2008, when the world was falling apart, I organized initially a subprime forum where I was able to ask my friends in the Fed if they would come down and have a panel discussion and a public presentation about the economics of the subprime meltdown. I have several friends at the Fed, several of them at the Richmond Fed, and they were happy to do that. Then again in 2011, I put together an economic symposium for the business community of Eastern North Carolina and invited some of my scholarly friends in the profession, as well as some more people in the Fed, to talk about what happened 3 years later and where we were. And I realized, with some help of my department chair and other people on the faculty, that this is the thing that universities should be doing. This is our mission. And we came to the idea that maybe we should start doing this every year.
Eastern North Carolina has a history, of course, of being a very rural area. Greenville is growing and has been growing at a tremendous rate lately. But in an area like this, issues of macroeconomics, things that are done on Wall Street, things that are done on K Street, it can all seem very remote. And when you do the symposium, is that something that you sometimes pick up on from even the business community, that all of this seems rather remote?
It's not remote, because it's definitely positively correlated. As the national economy goes, so will North Carolina's economy as well. North Carolina does have a large agricultural component, that's true, but it also has a large manufacturing component. And manufacturing will not be healthy unless the national economy is rising and growing well. If it's falling, North Carolina's economy is going to as well. Now, having said that, the Greenville area is, of course, connected to the university and the medical school, and it's the greatest source of income generation that we have. There's no doubt about it. But it's not unrelated to what goes on in K Street. Medical regulation, medical innovation that happens across the country, or rules that are passed in Congress, will apply to what goes on down on Fifth Street.
With this symposium, especially geared toward the business community here in Eastern North Carolina, in Greenville and Pitt County specifically, what ultimately do you hope they get out of this, and how do you hope this affects the way commerce is done in this region? And, you know, what sort of information do you want these people to walk away with and feel empowered with and use in their day-to-day lives?
I want them to know what economic science has to say about the major issues of the day. I want them to know about what economic research has to say about answering these important questions on the national debt, on income distribution, on regulation. And then once they're empowered with this information, whatever they decide is perfectly fine with me. I don't have a dog in this fight. What's most important to me is that we bring them, to the extent that we can, from the technical, research-based things that we know into information that they can use, high-valued information that is actionable. And then what they do from there is their business, but then we will have done our job.
That was Dr. Randall Parker, macroeconomist at East Carolina University and organizer of the annual Lunchtime Business Symposium on the State of the Economy. Registration is required for this ticketed event. If you want to find out more, go to our website, publicradioeast.org. The 2nd Marine Aircraft Wing is having its fall concert this weekend. Mac McKee speaks with Corporal Adam Dupree about the free performance Sunday afternoon.
How long has the 2nd Marine Aircraft Wing Band been around, and how long have you been a part of it?
Well, the 2nd Marine Aircraft Wing was commissioned in 1941 at Naval Air Station San Diego. The band has been around since 1946 and has been located at Marine Corps Air Station, Cherry Point, North Carolina. I've been part of the band since 2014.
Now, how many performances do you do each year, Corporal?
We do about 250 a year, with the majority of them along the eastern seaboard. We've also recently performed in Wisconsin, New Orleans, Mardi Gras, and Bermuda.
Wow. You do a lot of traveling then. You're probably not home a whole lot.
Yes, we do, sir.
How many people are in the band, and what's the setup of the instrumentation, Corporal?
The band currently consists of about 40 musicians, and it's comprised of woodwinds, brass, percussion, and rhythm players.
Are you a multi-instrumentalist? What do you play?
I play trombone, but I also can double as a euphonium player, and I also serve as a public affairs clerk for the band, a sound technician. There's many opportunities with the ensemble.
How long have you been a musician, sir?
I've been playing for about 16 years.
What types or genres of music do you perform in that format?
It's a good question. Our band has a variety of ensembles that cater to different events. We have a ceremonial band that primarily performs military ceremonies, as well as a concert band that is capable of performing the majority of wind ensemble literature. We also have brass quintets, a big band, a brass band, and a jazz combo, each catering to their coordinating genre, oftentimes with like a militaristic flair. Our big band's performing at the Duck Festival in Duck, North Carolina on Sunday, October 9th. We also have a show band that is perhaps the most eclectic of all the ensembles. It performs pop music, rock, country, R&B, and funk tunes. In fact, we're playing at the Havelock Chili Festival on Saturday, October 15th.
That should be a fun time ahead by all, as well as a lot of delicious food. Now, can you give us a preview of what folks can expect for your fall concert this particular weekend?
Of course. The concert will feature four different ensembles, a brass ensemble, big band, rock band, and a concert band. It will also feature a variety of soloists, to include a trombone quartet. The repertoire we'll be playing will consist of works by John Philip Sousa, Gustav Holst, Duke Ellington, and Gordon Goodwin.
Since the event is being held on base at Cherry Point, what do civilians need to know about getting to the Air Station Theater?
Well, the main gate, located at the intersection of Roosevelt and Fontana Boulevard, will open to the public beginning at noon. All civilians will need to present a valid ID to gain access on base. The Two Rivers Theater is located approximately 1.5 miles down Roosevelt Boulevard on the right.
And what time will the concert start, Corporal?
2 p.m., sir.
All right, Corporal Adam Dupree, thank you so much for being our guest today.
Thank you, Mac. Thanks for having me.
And if you need more information, visit the ENC events calendar at publicradioeast.org.
This is Lisa Rayburn, Horticulture Agent with Onslow County Cooperative Extension, here with this week's edition of The Garden Journal. Fall is officially here, and the gardening season is starting to wind down. but I'm already thinking about next year's garden. I have many colorful annuals in my garden, including 7 or 8 varieties of gorgeous sun coleus, many varieties of begonias, several ornamental sweet potato vines, alternanthera, and lots of succulents. Unfortunately, these plants will not survive over the winter here, and I'm just too frugal to buy more of the same plants next season. Since I don't have a greenhouse, each fall I root cuttings of these plants and store them over winter indoors. I like to take small, clean plastic pots or cell packs. These are the little divided trays that you buy seedlings in the spring. I fill the pots or flats with clean, fresh potting mix and water them thoroughly. Water should be dripping out the bottom of the potting mix. This is how I know that it is fully saturated, which is important to prevent the new cuttings from drying out. Once the pots or cell packs are ready, it's time to harvest my cuttings. I look for a cutting that is about 4 inches long. The node is where the leaf comes off of the stem. A 4-node cutting allows me to put 2 nodes below the soil surface, this is where the new roots will come from, and 2 nodes above the soil surface, this is where the new shoots and leaves of the plant will arrive. I remove the leaves from the bottom half of the cutting, usually the bottom 2 nodes. If the remaining leaves are very large, as is the case in sun coleus and some varieties of cane begonias, I will cut the remaining leaves in half to reduce the surface area and the amount of water lost from the leaves. Next, I use a dowel or pencil to create a small hole in the potting mix. I want the hole just wide enough to slide the stem of the cutting down in it. Then I use my stick to gently guide the cutting into the hole and firm the potting mix around the base of the cutting. Next, I cover the plants to prevent them from drying out before they're able to grow new roots. For plants in individual pots, I often pull plastic sandwich bags down over the cuttings and the top of the pot to create a miniature greenhouse environment over the plant. For cell packs, I'll often slide a tray into a large clear or white plastic trash bag. I use chopsticks or pieces of dowel to keep the plastic from laying directly on top of the plant material. The new cuttings need to be placed in a location out of direct sun. After 3 or 4 weeks, the cuttings should be starting to send out new leaves. I will gently tug on a leaf to determine if the cutting is firmly rooted and holding on to the soil. If so, I start to gradually open up the plastic enclosure. I may adjust the bag or dome so it is slightly open for 3 to 4 days, then open it a little wider for another 3 to 4 days. At the end of the week, I should be able to remove the bag or humidity dome altogether. Once the cuttings are fully rooted, I move them to a location with light, such as a south or west-facing window, or better yet, under some supplemental lights. Succulents can be rooted in the same manner that I just described, but succulents are adapted to low moisture environments, so they should not be covered with a humidity dome or bag, or they will rot. Many succulents are actually more attractive if you root new ones from year to year, as they tend to get leggy and awkward in their second season. These newly rooted cuttings will add color and interest to my home during the winter months, and it will save me money and give me a jump start on my gardening next spring.
This Saturday, Interfaith Refugee Ministry is hosting Dinner on 5 Continents. Enjoy a small plate international menu featuring cuisines from around the world.
My name is Susan Husson. I'm the Executive Director of Interfaith Refugee Ministry. Dinner on 5 Continents is meant to be a gourmet dinner with foods from all 5 continents, an evening of silent auction, and also some ethnic entertainment to kind of fit in with our organization and what we do with people from around the world. We have some food from Africa. One of them is called keftu. It's a lamb meatball seasoned with toasted North African spices. We have food from Asia, rempa from Indonesia. That is the spice paste that flavors Indonesian chicken. We have European dishes as well, and an antipasti plate from the Mediterranean area. We also have, of course, something from North America as well. We have Charleston shrimp and grits and a seasonal autumn vegetable skewer glazed in maple balsamic reduction. And to top it all off, at the end we will have cookies from various countries as our dessert. We will have dancers. Their ethnicity is Matu from Burma. They will be dancing. We also have another person from Burma who will be playing the guitar and singing. And then we will also have singers from our newest caseload, which is people from the Democratic Republic of Congo. So they will be singing. Dinner on Five Continents is Saturday, October 1st. Doors open at 6 o'clock. We'll probably start serving around 6:30. It's at the Christchurch Harrison Center, which is in New Bern at 311 Middle Street. For more information on this nonprofit event, go to publicradioeast.org's events calendar.
Thanks for listening to the Down East Journal this week. If you have questions, comments, or ideas for features, drop us a line at publicradioeast.org.